This episode is brought to you by VMGVinyl.com. Professional record cleaning, restoration, rejuvenation, and grading.
Refresh your records with VMGVinyl.com.
And with that, on with the show. Well, hey everyone, welcome to episode 426 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds, and this week I'm very pleased to be sharing a conversation I recently had with musician, producer, and absolutely brilliant songwriter, Alain Johannes. He goes by both Alain and Alan, so those are interchangeable. Now, for those of you unfamiliar with Alan's work, he's had an incredible career, starting off in high school, playing with a group of fellas that went on to become the Red Hot Chili Peppers. But of course, Alan cut his own path, formed his own bands, including What Is This, Anthem, Walk the Moon, and ultimately the band 11 with his partner Natasha Schneider. Now, 11 was an incredible band, which garnered a devoted fan base around the world and drew in musicians like Mark Lanegan, Chris Cornell, and even Josh Homme into their creative fold. Now, as a duo, Alan and Natasha co-wrote much of Chris Cornell's solo album, Euphoria Morning, while Alan also played with Queens of the Stone Age, Them Crooked Vultures, he's on a ton of the Desert Sessions with Josh Homme, and lots more. Alan and Natasha's creative center was the band 11, which gave the world five incredible albums, with the final record, Howling Book, released in 2003. Now, tragically, Natasha passed away in 2008, and Alan has continued playing and releasing music, including the gorgeous and heart-wrenching LPs Spark and Hum, both available on Ipecac Records. Now, today, Alan and I talk a lot about the final 11 album, Howling Book, which will be released on vinyl for the very first time December 1st. It's a double record set, packaged with three outtakes, and it's a mini miracle we're able to get this on vinyl, which Alan and I talk about today. So reserve your copy of 11's Howling Book on vinyl at your local record shop, or order your copy at orgmusic.com. And finally, I'm here to ask you, if you're new to the Vinyl Guide podcast, please follow us in your podcast app of choice. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, whatever. We have over 400 other episodes and interviews available anytime, including Matt Cameron of Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, and even spent some time with the band 11. He joined us on episode 425 of The Vinyl Guide. Justin Chancellor of Tool joined us episode 417. The late Sixto Sugarman Rodriguez from the Searching for Sugarman movie, episode 408. Ross Knight of the Mighty Cosmic Psychos, episode 385. Gerald V. Casale of Devo, episode 366. And heaps more. All free, all available to enjoy anytime. There's no paywall, just sharing for the love of music and records. Again, just follow the Vinyl Guide podcast in your podcast app of choice and enjoy. And with that, let's get into our conversation with Alain Johannes on revisiting 11 and more.
Oh,
¿cómo está usted?
Hello, ¿cómo yo estoy bien y usted?
And that is the end of my high school Spanish.
That's pretty good, though. How's it going? Good. All good.
Good. Good. I hope you're well.
What I need to do here? Why am I not seeing myself?
I don't know. Is that an existential question?
Yeah. Exactly. Let me see. Video. Yeah. Okay. Right. So that's it. I'm there. But why can't I see? Yeah. Oh, I see. Oh. There it is. Start
hey,
video.
There we go. There you are.
How's it going?
Our first victory of the day.
Oh, yes. Well, there was a bit of a hang yesterday with a band that I produced, and like a little daytime barbecue, and I ended up probably having a little too much wine. So today is a slow Sunday for me.
Okay, fair enough. I won't throw you any curly ones early here.
No, I'm totally fine. I've adjusted. I'm absolutely 100%. I swear.
Excellent. Well, great to see you, man. And look, Alan, I've always wanted to have you here on the show. We talk about records and collecting and music and that sort of thing. And so
exactly.
I know Howling Book is getting ready to come out. I want to talk plenty on that because I'm very excited about that. First off, are you a bit of a record collector? Do you have a record collection?
I used to a couple of times. And then the last collection that I had I got a little bit left in storage, but I was really disheartened when I was in my early 20s. I had a van full of my records. I was temporarily moving, staying with a friend, and the van got stolen from in front of the house. It had probably maybe about 1,500 vinyl in it. You know, Blue Notes and Melodias and you know, a lot of my Impulse and, you know, all that Elektra stuff, the Queen catalog on, remember I was on Elektra with the, and
Butterfly.
Butterfly, yeah. And God, all my stuff since I was a kid. A lot of Paco de Lucia stuff, you know. No. But I started up again. I probably got to a few hundred, and then I ended up when I moved from 11 AD, you know, when I got out of the studio house, that's so much stuff, like so many decades of stuff. I ended up just putting things in storage, giving stuff away. But I'm excited to start another collection soon. As soon as I figure out where I'm going to land, I'm kind of floating around this year, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to have a record collection when you're and ship it and carry it around the world, I guess.
Yeah. I'm still trying to figure out where I'm going to end up. So I took this year to just travel between Europe and Chile and coming back to the States in February. So I'm kind of floating around. And then, yeah, I'm sure, you know, I can't wait to because there's a lot of amazing new reissues too, you know, and it's become quite the thing again, really. It's you can see that.
It really is fun. And there's no better time machine than a record in my book.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I mean, still nothing is, I mean, obviously, you know, we live through vinyl turning into CDs and then people are missing the physicality of CDs, but imagine the physicality of vinyl with the artwork so big and you can hold it in your hand and you know, to the record, you know, while accessing, you know, the lyrics and the feel of the artwork, you know, interested in like who did what, who recorded what, where it was recorded, you know, who mixed it, mastered it, the thank yous, all that stuff that seems to be so not part of like a lot of the, you know, more current way of doing things.
Yeah.
Like,
you know, when I was young, by scouring record sleeves, I learned who was the manager of the band, who did the artwork, you know,
exactly.
They became kind of figures in my own mind too. So Howling Book coming out on vinyl.
Yes.
This is December 1st. Mm-hmm. This is the first time Howling Book has been on vinyl. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah. Because we were kind of a little bit over the label situation by then, you know, Jack had just come back from being in Pearl Jam and we decided to just put it out on our own. So I remember had it mastered by Dave Collins, who I always work with. And then I, through disc makers, ended up making CDs and then those got, you know, sent around the world and stuff. Digipak at first, you know, cause it felt nice. And then we did another run. But I mean, so yeah, this is the first time that it actually existing on vinyl. And we're doing double vinyl because, you know, in the age of CD, you could have a 50-some-minute record, 54-minute record. It wasn't a big deal. But, you know, for vinyl, it's too long in terms of getting quality. So we've we had three songs from that time period. That could have been at least feel wise that they kind of belong to the same sessions, you know. So we ended up putting those on side four or side D, and Howling Book takes up three sides, you know. So it's got a nice quality there. You know, the lengths are just perfect for it. So it's great because, you know, I mean, you remember how many of our vinyl records were like in between. What is it, 20, you know, 29, 34, 30, you know, all the lengths. I mean, and then these came out, and suddenly you could have an hour-long record.
Yeah, and that was used to better or worse effect, depending on how good the band was at being able to manage the edits.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, I remember always having, like I always liked my double vinyl, too. Like, you know, physical graffiti, some of the Yes stuff. It always seemed like such a journey, or like Four-Way Street, you know. I think that was even four vinyls. I can't remember now. The Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. You know, and I, you know, I when I was a kid, I used to go to Licorice Pizza, ended up doing a little bit of weekend cleaning up for Vinyl, you know, like a little unofficial job. I was like 15. So I lived between Tower Records and the Whiskey, the street called Larrabee, right? And right there was the Licorice Pizza was on San Vicente. And that's where Doug Feiger was working at the time. And then there was a couple of cool guys that turned me on to stuff. I would go in there and like ask if, you know, what should I be listening to? You know, can you? And I discovered a lot of cool stuff that there, you know, 10cc. And I remember they had an import section and I would just, you know, something about the cover, you know, like Gonga Zeus, for example, with Discovered Alan Holdsworth. I was still like maybe like 14, 15 years old. And it was the cover. Remember getting you hadn't heard of these bands or you know, but the cover just made you do
spoke
it.
Spoke to you. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. And almost always it was right on. It was perfect, you know.
So you actually worked at a record store. I mean, it sounds like you as a young man, yeah. A little bit of cleaning up, a little bit of
you know, like they, you know, they had boxes, and I would kind of water the parking lot, and I'd, you know, I did that over the weekend. I'd get a vinyl, but I remember like having this choice between Aerosmith Rocks, Night at the Opera, and Physical Graffiti. Obviously, I chose Physical Graffiti because it was double, but ended up. It's amazing when around the time period that so many of these records were coming out, that there was so many classics. Records coming out at the same time. It's amazing to me.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that period in LA, there was a lot of punk going. Did you go to a lot of the early punk shows? I know.
I did. I was crazy about Fear, especially too, you know, and obviously, you know, growing up at the time, my band, What Is This, you know, was before the Pepper. So it was Flea, Hello, Jack, and I, and we'd run around and not only go see bands, but also we played on the same bill, you know, I mean, 45 Grave, Black Flag, you know, Circle Jerks. The Germs, X.
Oh, you played with the Germs.
No. I mean, not in the band, but you know.
No, I know. Yeah, but on the same bill.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, exactly. You know, Wong's East, Wong's West. There were so many cool clubs. You know, you could basically, I found like a not really a diary, but I just kind of would write things down. And one of the, I think it was 82 that I was actually played like over 100 shows that year between. My solo stuff, my little jazz improv band, What Is This? You know, the accompanying performance artists with Ebo tape loops. And there was so many different, there was a lot of activity. I mean, I was surprised, like, wow, you know. And sometimes you got a little bit of money. Sometimes they fed you. Sometimes, you know, the nothing. But it was really an active, I loved LA in the 80s. It was amazing.
Hmm. Now, I heard a story, correct? Correct or confirm here. Now, Flea joined What Is This as a bass player, but he didn't play bass prior to that.
So, no, but, yeah.
So you got exactly. to watch him kind of form, especially in the early days.
Well, I mean, it wasn't What Is This yet. We were in high school, and our mm-hmm. Bassist decided that he would concentrate on studies, and so he quit the band. We were in the 11th grade. And so, but 12th grade, you know, Flea played jazz trumpet, and his stepfather was a jazz bassist, and so he was an amazing musician already. So he came to my house and Hillel's house. We basically had 3 months because we had the Battle of the Bands at the Gazzari's that we had booked, so we needed to bring him up to speed. And so he started playing with us, and then Anthony Kiedis was also in high school but he was more concentrating on drama and the plays and things like that, you know. So once he was in the band with us, we turned into What Is This. We played a bunch of years together. Then after we would go see Fear all the time, he basically left, you know, to join Fear for a little bit. And I remember Hillel was really upset and almost didn't talk to him for a little bit. And then out of that period, basically the Chili Peppers were born around the same time that we were playing. So we would share members and, it worked out, and then, you know, for a little while, and then we both got offered record deals, and Hillel and Jack decided to stay with me for the first, you know, the EP and the Todd Rundgren produced vinyl. I think that was the last time No, actually, 11's first record was on vinyl, but What Is This? Squeeze, the EP Dave Jordan produced, and Todd Rundgren's the self-titled, that was vinyl. Both of those were vinyl. But by the time Natasha and I had Walk the Moon, it was already only CDs, you know? And I remember those really long packs that it came with all this artwork, these long cardboard packs, and then you'd get basically take that and throw it away.
Just the long box, yeah.
Yeah, the long box, so much real estate there, but it was for nothing, you know? But,
no,
yeah.
you know what those were for? Those are so the record store didn't have to change out their record racks.
Exactly.
They could put CDs in there. Yeah.
Exactly. I remember because they would suddenly use the same racks for put on. You could fit several, you know, I think it would be three of them side by side were like one vinyl or something, right?
Yeah.
Is that the idea?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the furniture people came in and said, no, we're going to make special new furniture for you.
Now, there were a couple other things that were happening around this time. Apparently, there was some session work. There was a version of Riders on the Storm for Annabelle
yes.
Lamb.
Yes, I played a solo on that. It was like when they wanted Robert Fripp or Adrian Belouber, you couldn't really afford them. Or, you know, you got Al to come in and do the weirdo solo, you know.
You're the guy they call when Robert Fripp's busy. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know. Obviously, like that kind of was in that world a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
That's what I was into. We were listening to a lot of Talking Heads, and I was a huge Bowie fan, and Zappa, mm-hmm. obviously with Blue and Crimson. And but as a matter of fact, I had a pretty decent job, and I bought tickets for us to see Discipline at the Roxy three nights, or two nights. I can't remember now. It was two shows a night, and I got tickets for. Me and Hillel and Jack and Flea and Anthony, we all, and my friend JK, I don't know, at the time it must have been, you know, a couple hundred bucks, $300 or something for it. But I got to see that band that, you know, in 1980, and amazing wow. to be right in front of that. Yeah. With Bruford and Tony Levin and Robert sitting in the dark, kind of, you know, always sitting and kind of looking at everybody smiling while playing all this crazy stuff. He never looked at his neck.
So very early on, you knew music was going to be your path. There was no other alternate. A moment where it just kind of hit you that's just what's going to happen?
Well, I was really young. I was like four when my uncle Peter, who's a pretty famous entertainer musician in Chile, and at the time he would come stay with us, and he put a guitar in my hand and showed me the basic chords, and I was already. In the 60s, I was born in 62. So by the time I was four and five, I was a huge Beatles freak, you know, and I would make my mom buy me singles. And I had a bunch of the 45s and and I would kind of ear pick out the chords. So that was already like such a huge thing for me. And then when we moved to Mexico City, my mom's neighbors were super hip, British couple, and they had an amazing record collection, and they would bring stuff over. So I heard my first Sabbath, Hendrix, Paco de Lucia, you know, the soundtrack to Jesus Christ Superstar for some reason really spoke to me. That's the movie was playing at the time, always with people picketing it in front, you know. that was it, like, you know, listening to records, playing music, and I knew that's what I wanted to be. I mean, my uncle would come and rehearse with his band in the living room, and I you know, kind of coax them into going to you know, just ask them, because they would say Tierra la Vista means land in sight. Mm-hmm. Which means they go to the balcony and smoke some pot, you know. And so I knew that if they did that, they'd be gone for like 2-3 hours. And right. So I had access to the Rhodes and the drum set and the flute and the, you know, the guitar. Or so I could play there, the instruments that they were just sitting there.
Wow.
You know.
And then from Mexico to Los Angeles. I mean, yeah. How lucky were you to be parachuted into what was essentially ground zero of the music
scene? I know. And especially like straight to Laurel Canyon, 101 Avenue, my aunt Frankie, my uncle's ex-wife at the time, was living there, and we could stay with her. And I didn't speak any English. I mean, a couple words here and there. And then I went to Bancroft Junior High, and that's where I met Hillel and Jack when we were like 14 years old. actually, the way that I met Chuck was really funny. We were in homeroom together, and he was wearing a Gene Simmons outfit because they were doing the talent show dressed as Kiss. They were huge Kiss fans, you know. And as he walked past me, I, you know, the cod piece, as he's walking past, I just in my mind thought, I wonder how protective that is. So I just kind of give a quick punch. And he started screaming and he got angry. And then he told Hillel, this kid just punched me in the... And he goes, what's he look like? Oh, I heard him play guitar. He's really, really good. We should jam with him. And so we started jamming together. That was, you know, that was a huge part of our development. I mean, I'd already been playing for many more years than they had, but there was something about our connection and the fact that we could go to Jack's house and literally jam from like 4 till 8 every single day for years, you know, and then all day on the weekends. So that was a huge, imagine what kind of development that is, you know, to be able to learn music together, write our first songs, play the, you know, our first shows, you know, all that's that whole life was really, really amazing. And had I stayed in Mexico City at the time, and, you know, Mexico's got a lot of amazing musicians and they love rock music and stuff. But at the time, it would have been really a completely different thing, you know.
Yeah.
Because I got to be exposed to so much stuff and living right there, you know, on the Sunset Strip, you know. I mean, between Tower and there was the Whiskey, the Roxy, the Gazaris, Filthy McNasty's at the time, which became the Central, which became the Viper Room, you know. Mm-hmm. Actually, if you know the, you know, Sweet Desolation Boulevard,
yeah.
That cover, that's exactly what stuff looked like when I was living. There's a Power Burger, Watergate Dog, Book Soup, the early small Book Soup, you know.
Yeah.
So cool.
Now I've noticed more and more of your credits are recorded by Alan Johannes.
Yes.
And that's got to be in more than just engineering. What does it mean, recorded by?
Well, I mean, it's basically like when I'm producing stuff, only a couple of times did I record something and not produce it. That was No Doubt, Return of Saturn. Glenn Ballard produced and I recorded it. And, you know, but most of the time it's kind of like a blanket produced, recorded, mixed, you know. I think it's an elegant, just as simple, you know, because it can mean all that stuff. And sometimes when it says produced, engineered, mixed, mastered by, it kind of looks like a bit too like, oh, really? Huh?
yeah, a bit heavy-handed.
Yeah, I mean, stuff by Al is kind of what I'm hoping to eventually get to. But like on my solo stuff, you know, I'm recording it and performing it and stuff.
Your solo material, do you hear the music in your head before recording it? Like, are you in the process of trying to take what's in your head and put it on tape, or are you still just in that exploration of the idea and then refining it on tape?
I think what happens to me, especially lately, is that especially because I use Instagram as kind of my canvas, I do a lot of improvising on there, you know, and I kind of. The last three records, I've literally just created while recording, you know? So Hum was the most intense. Hum, it took me 12 days to do the entire record, and I only had the chord sequence to the first song. And the rest was literally in the morning, I would imagine, okay, that's the first song on the record. What's next? How does the record evolve? And so I kind of was trying to tune into to some point beyond space time where the album's already finished and it's badass, you know. I'm like, I'm gonna go towards that, you know. And so it I think because I've been playing so long and I've worked on so many things, and I just allow myself to trust myself and just go for it with that. I don't overthink. I just do it, you know. And almost every time that you know, I'm reading the lyrics while singing because I just wrote them, you know. Spark was 4 days. I was in, you know, Natasha had passed away, and it was my ode to her. And it was really kind of bizarre, almost mystical in a way. I could feel her presence because we were so used to working together all the time whenever we did music. In 11 and Euphoria Morning, Chris Cornell, that we recorded and produced with Chris at the house, that that I just kind of like, almost like she was in my mind. She was feeding me the idea, like, oh, now you need to do like a three-part voice section that kind of has a vibe like the Georgian voices or this, you know, that kind of thing. It's almost like I've been very lucky the last period that I can just kind of, it has to build up, like the initial energy has to build up enough where I know, okay, I'm making a record, and then it just kind of happens, and it's intense, and then it's finished, and then like Hum, you know, like I told you, 12 Days Fragments was about the same. Fragments and Holes basically came up from every single song comes from a little jam that I had on Instagram, you know. So you can go through my posts and hear the seedlings of every single song on that record.
Hmm. With something like Spark, and you know, that was a big record, of course, emotionally. That was your first post-Natasha release. Yeah. And you know, you had a lot to say. That was a few years after Natasha had passed. How did you know that it was time to do it?
We'll be back after these messages.
Well, hey there, record collectors. There's a new service available that specializes in record cleaning, restoring, sticker removal, and professional grading.
VMGVinyl.com.
VMG Vinyl can help you make the most of your collectible records. From professional cleaning of records and sleeves,
removing old price tags and store stickers,
dry cleaning and rejuvenation of old shrink wrap to make it look like new, even providing you a professional play-tested third-party grade with either removable grading or encasing in plastic, you have a wide range of choices at VMGVinyl.com.
Buying a highly collectible record and you want it checked out by an expert?
VMG Vinyl can do that too. Head over there now and see what VMGVinyl.com can do for you and your collection. That's VMGVinyl.com, the one-stop shop for professional third-party grading, cleaning, and record restoration. That's VMGVinyl.com.
Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE. 10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits. With something like Spark, that was a big record, of course, emotionally. That was your first post-Natasha release. Yeah. And, you know, you had a lot to say. That was a few years after Natasha had passed. How did you know that it was time to do it?
Yeah, it was only a couple of years after I recorded in 2010. We were on break from the Crooked Vultures tour. Yeah, 1 week off, and my mom was staying with me, and she had fought cancer and survived the first time, and then it was coming back, and eventually I ended up, you know, being her, you know, being there for her nurse and stuff, but she was taking care of me at the time. And it allowed me to just kind of like, you know, go make this record inside the control room. I basically chose the palette before doing it. I had my cigar box guitar. I knew that was going to be the heart of it because of the sonority. I had taken it with me on tour with Crooked Vultures and was always jamming on it, you know, with JPJ playing mandolin and me playing cigar box. You know, we do hour-long jams. Late night drives, you know, and it had this kind of like this first of all, this very folky vibe because it's an 8-string instrument, that cigar box size. So it kind of sounds like a deeper mandolin, but it also has aspects of like a Arabic music or flamenco music, especially because, you know, I use my, you know, flamenco-ish technique that I had learned since I was a kid. And so it was just this perfect the way that the voice sat with that, and the way that the music started to come out, the songs, you know, because I really only had two or three little bits of ideas, but lyrically, obviously, it came together really, really intensely at the moment, because every single song of Spark is almost like a different aspect of the grief and the shock, and also the, you know, at the same time being really blessed and thankful for having, you know, spent 25 years with your soulmate, you know. And you know, Spark was something else. It certainly, when it was done, it just felt like it wasn't, not that it wasn't me, but it was like a, like you wake up and you have amnesia, or someone hypnotizes you and you have no recollection. I mean, I had a kind of a dim recollection of recording it, but it was almost like it happened to me, you know. The album just kind of happened.
Was it a catharsis? Was it?
Yeah, catharsis for sure. Even though I really wasn't thinking, you know, I was just kind of dope. And my mom would, like, you know, say, hey, you need to eat something here. You know, here's some food. Time to sleep or whatever, you know. Literally, like, you know, 4 or 5 days is all it took. And and then I was going to put it out on my own. And Josh heard it and says, no. We need to take this to someone. And he was just starting a relationship with Ipecac, you know, Mike Patton's label, who, you know, we'd done Desert Sessions, and they come out on Ipecac in the early 2000s. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I love Greg Workman and I love Mike Patton, and it's a really cool label in terms of, you know, it's a great artistic home, you know, and you just kind of do your thing and they support you after fact, you know?
Yeah. So doing Howling Book now and revisiting some of the tapes, some of the outtakes, the three songs, This Little Finger, I think, Rosebleed.
Yeah.
Those were 100% done. Did you have to do any refining on them to make
it? No, just mixing. I mean, This Little Finger, I mixed and it had come out as a CD single with an outtake from Thunk called Took Me for a Ride. And a live version of You Haven't Done Nothing that we did in a cold rehearsal where we used to rehearse, you know, Rage used to rehearse there too. Mm. So that was a single that came out at some point. Can't remember exactly when now. And Rosebleed, I mixed probably about a year ago. And I just love that song because... it's very interesting. It's a very heavily clavinet. Natasha was playing a lot of clavinet on it. This amazing clavinet C that I'd gifted her. And I actually took it to the studio when we were doing Crooked Vultures and John Paul Jones played don't stand. It's just like, whoa, that's exactly the same sound. Running through a little Fender amp. And it was so bizarre to hear, you know. Anyway, yeah, Rosebleed is a really cool song and Get Me Down. You know, I think there was a period of recording before and after, you know, the main thing. And I can't remember exactly why we didn't think about those songs being part of the record. But I don't think it wasn't like we decided. It was like, I think it was because we already done the record, you know, or we had decided what the record was. And those songs came around it and were never, you know, thought of as like, oh, we didn't, this doesn't work. And, you know, it was more like we have these songs, you know, we recorded them. And then it's a time period, you know, 2002 to 2004.
I guess with you guys owning the studio and, you know, it all being right there, there's probably a lot of outtakes. I mean, you guys were constantly recording and some of them would get bundled up as a project, as an album, and others would just be fragments rotating around it like moons.
I mean, we tried not to, because what happened is when we got signed to A&M Records and we put out Avant-Garde Dog, which we actually recorded before Euphoria Morning, but it came out after, because Chris was staying with us after Soundgarden broke up the first time, or they stopped for a while. And he invited Al Kafar, the president, to hear our stuff. And Al loved our stuff, and he offered us a record deal. And then Natasha and I were ballsy enough to walk into his office and ask him for the entire amount of the record deal to buy a studio for the house. So he could just do it our own. And he said, yes. And no one could believe that kids, it would never, you know, the policy was always rent it and instead of giving, you know, so they don't, it was weird, you know, like it actually worked out. And that's how we, you know, made Avant Garde Dog, you know. And so what happened with Avant Garde Dog is like we had done a bunch of, Jack had left to join Pearl Jam during the Thunk era. And then we got a drummer called Greg Upchurch, who was the drummer for that period, and Euphoria Morning. He eventually joined Puddle of Mud and Three Doors Down after, you know, Jack came back. But anyway, we had had a whole bunch of batch of songs that we did on our previous setup, which is just a little 8-track recorder, a Tascam. And by the time it came to do the record, we felt they were too old. It didn't, you know, they were like a year and a half old. They didn't really represent, you know. So what happened is that we started to not write and record in between albums as much because we didn't want things to not be current. I mean, wanted the energy to be really fresh. So between Avant Garde Dog and Howling Book, we didn't really, maybe two or three things here and there. And then the very last recording sessions, we finished five songs. We didn't finish, but we tracked five songs with Jack and Natasha in 2007. And then like the next few days after, she got diagnosed, and then we just, you know, they never got finished. And so they're really amazing instrumental tracks that need vocals. So I thought after Natasha passed away, you know, we're just sitting on them. I thought I'm going to get Chris and Mark Lanigan to sing on it. And maybe Polly asked her if she would like to, or Brody. And you know, it became like, I think we're like now, I think I'm just going to have to sing them because, you know, my friends keep going away you know, but yeah, they're really cool. They have a little bit of that Physical Graffiti vibe. We recorded in the living room, everything, you know, just in a circle around each other. And it's a very live vibe. So it's five songs. I think at some point it'd be really cool to have an EP and let that finally come out.
Wow. So lyrics are written and everything. Is that right?
Yeah. So, I mean, some ideas, they have titles, but we never finished the last part would have been to write the melody and the lyrics. But musically speaking, the songs instrumentally are all there. I just have to kind of imagine how we would have finished them, you know.
Oh, and Chris never got a chance to, no one got a chance to kind of put a bit, the no. idea, the intent was there, but it just never.
Yeah. We didn't get around to it. And Mark too, they all loved the stuff and we're totally down to do it. We just didn't get around to it. Just time passes and you don't expect things to go the way they did, you know. It was, you know, quite intense and shocking.
So there's something, and I don't think I've ever shared this on the show before, but in 2017, we were making arrangements for Chris to come on this show.
Yeah.
Just before he passed. And in fact, I'd already had the research and all the notes and everything kind of sorted. One of the questions that I had was something you may be able to help with for Euphoria Morning. The project, when it originally came out, it was spelled Euphoria Morning, as in time of day, morning.
Yeah.
But originally, it was supposed to be morning with a U, as the, you know, the act of mourning. Yeah. Do you recall that transition?
I recall that after at the time, it was morning, and that's what it was, and no one had ever discussed. He never discussed like, oh, I wish it should have been this or the other. That conversation that supposedly happened with him getting advice to change it was something that you know, I read about afterwards. But we didn't discuss it. Like, he didn't say, oh, yeah, you know, it really should have. I really wanted it to be morning. At the time, we just went ahead and you know, it was morning. And then later on, when, you know, funny enough, the reissue obviously became morning. And you, I happened to be the one that made it possible because I found the original mixes in a very rare digital format in my storage because it had been lost. And then all I asked, and I arranged for it to be mastered, you know, from the original mixes. with Dave Collins, who mastered the original. And so this is the first time it was mastered for vinyl. And all I asked the guy at Universal, like, okay, I got all this stuff done, and now I want a copy, please. Yeah, yeah, of course. And then finally I go, so what? He goes, oh, we're all out. I'm so sorry. Thank you. Anyway, yeah. So I don't know. I don't know. Like, we, Chris and I, you know, we never spoke about like that, but it made perfect sense that maybe he would have had that conversation. And I guess the idea, the thing that happened is that it thought it was too dark or something, you know, or too artistic or confusing.
Yeah. Yeah. And for people who may not know what we're talking about here, Euphoria Morning, in the 20, I think it was 2015, the reissue, that it was retitled Morning with a U.
And, with a U, as he originally wanted it to be.
Yeah. And the in the liner notes, it was something to the effect of, you know, it's the title's been changed to its original intent because at the time he listened to some, quote, bad advice. Right.
Yeah.
So yeah. Now it's interesting. You found the mixes in an obscure file. What was that file? I'm curious about that.
Well, no. Basically, at the time, it was 99. Mm-hmm. We had recorded in Pro Tools, early Pro Tools. Obviously, the studio. You know, we had a tape machine. We had all, you know, Neves and good stuff. And the mixdown, we wanted to. Whatever was the highest possible quality converter wise at the time for digital mixdown, you know. And so there was a special Sony machine. It kind of looked like a DAT tape, but a little bit bigger than the DAT tape, you know, the media. It wasn't something that consumers knew about. It was very much like a professional, you know. There was PCM 100s. There was a lot of like dedicated digital recorders that were used at the time. So we rented this machine, mixed down into these tapes, and then basically was doing two copies of everything, you know. So we had a copy we put in the archives, and then a copy that I kept and put in a box and put it in storage. And literally when they asked me, I just had this image of Word, because you imagine the storage is just endless boxes and stuff, you know. And I kind of went to this one box that was just sitting there unmarked and opened it up, and there they were, you know.
Wow.
So that was really cool. And then we found the machine, the one that was working again, and took that to, you know, Dave Collins that had it. And then I went in and he mastered it for vinyl. And I love that we get another chance to look at that aspect of it, you know. I think it's really, really enhanced from the original version, the vinyl mastering, and even the digital WAV files that were used to cut the vinyl, you know. I have those, and they're amazing to listen to. And you know, I'm sure those are the ones that get converted for streaming as well, you know.
And one day the record label may actually send you a copy. Who knows?
Yeah,
maybe.
I'm gonna try to find it. Just they're so hard to find. I'm what it's like on this dog. Sometimes you end up like, okay, well, I'm not really anywhere where it could get to me, right. or like, you know, especially here in Chile, like the customs holds everything forever. Mm-hmm. But
what was his mood going into that? Because Soundgarden had just broken up. He was at this kind of crossroads of his career. What do you remember about his state of creativity at that time?
He stayed with us for a few months, and then we're having a good time exploring things. And then he basically, before we started recording the album, we weren't supposed to be the producers. Daniel Lanois was going to produce it. So Chris, Natasha, and I were, preparing the song. So I've written music for Disappearing One, Follow My Way, Mission. Natasha had written Pillow of Your Bones. He wrote the melody and lyrics. We were working. Natasha was rearranging, doing a lot of arranging of the harmonic and the chordal motions of the demos. And so we spent about 6 weeks preparing all this stuff, you know, getting it ready for it to be recorded. And then the day before he was supposed to go and start, we got a phone call that the Daniel Lanois had canceled all his projects. And Chris is like, what are we going to do? What am I going to do? And Natasha goes, what do you mean? What are you going to do? He got us a studio. We have a studio right here. Let's start tomorrow. So we did the record pretty much in secret for, you know, many, many months.
Mm-hmm. Was there high confidence from him in the material, in the project? Again, his first solo record, kind of.
Yeah.
I imagine it would have been kind of a bit of a scary thing to be stepping out on his own there.
Yeah, he didn't really exhibit any fear, because we had this amazing connection, and musically we knew we were doing something amazing. I know that he definitely wanted to explore other possibilities for his voice and songwriting, being into R&B and you know, all the music that he loved. So it was just, you can hear much more of a you know, the not only R&B but also like the kind of melodic post Beatley kind of stuff, a heavy Natasha's harmonic complexity and beauty, and just what the interests of the three of us, you know, would have been. And and we were having an amazing time. Like, he would literally, it was no pressure, because we just at our house, at our studio, you know, home studio, and he would, you know, some days we'd get up and he'd be like, let's go to the beach today, you know, or let's go see a movie, or you know, Natasha would get so upset because him and I were like exploring sounds, you know. So 7 hours into looking for a guitar to get the guitar tone, because we could, you know, she's like, okay, already, I hate it, you know, like, well, we didn't try this app with this pedal, with this guitar, with this thing, through this guy, and then blah blah. Because we were like totally free to do whatever we could. There was no pressure. And, you know, so I think that's what makes the record really interesting too, because it's basically best friends hanging out and making music without any interference, and just enjoying the moment, you know.
Now, you mentioned you found that tape for Euphoria Morning. The 11 album catalog is almost entirely, each album's on a different label. Do you have the masters, the tapes for each one of those? Because my next question is going to be, when do you think we're going to see those on vinyl?
Oh man, I wish. I do not. And one of the labels doesn't even exist, and there's no one to talk to about it.
It's Hollywood.
They're still around. Oh. They have 11-11 and Thunk. Those tapes, who knows where they are? You know what it's like? Every time you reach out to these people, they say, well, you still owe us $500,000. Or, you know, it would have to be very expensive. Like, if you're asking, they're like, why are you asking? You know, what's going on? You know, so you can't. I really wish that we could you get everything back? And I could, like, in some cases, I would love to remix, like a first record, would mix it again, maybe, you know, or at least master it. But Avant-Garde Dog, we have, and Howling Book, we have, you know. So those two, the first three, I would love to get the rights back eventually, you know. So who knows? I mean, there's always a possibility of just kind of like, oops, look, it's a bunch of vinyl. Who made that? Oh, my God. That's terrible.
Yeah.
Okay. Who's going to know? As he says over a podcast, everyone's going to listen to about.
Okay, so what I'm hearing is the first three, probably a no, unless a mini miracle happens.
Yeah, I think we could even go for the very first one, because there's nobody around from that label, you know.
Right.
So it's not streaming, you know. The Awaken a Dream is not on any streaming service. It doesn't exist. It only exists as a fan uploading it onto, even though that's the one that has vinyl on Discogs there. But so that doesn't, people can't even stream it. It's not, nobody's claimed the rights to that. So I'm sure I could figure out a way to like say, hey, what a second. Well, since you guys are not, since no one's around for, you know, to talk about this, you know, but it's just, yeah.
Do you have the multi-tracks? Could you actually do a remix if you wanted?
No, I don't. Sadly, all that we could do is take take the digital recordings that I do have and treat them a certain way to try to master them for vinyl, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's not, I don't, they kept all those, you know, And I don't think if there's no one from the label even around, you know, like the chances of them knowing where those tapes are.
Right. Okay.
You know, so
how about even going back to Squeeze, San Andreas Records? Do you have the tapes that for was, those?
No, that was MCA, that and the Todd Rundgren record. Those 2-inch tapes are somewhere, I suppose MCA would have them. But that was, God, that was 83, 84, 85. I just don't know. I need to ask a lawyer and see what the possibility, because that's another thing. Those aren't streaming either. Those are only YouTube. People have copies, and yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy. Walk the Moon, the same thing. You know, that before there was the modern Walk the Moon, there was Natasha and I's Walk the Moon in 86, you know.
Yeah. MTV. Yeah. I had Andy Partridge from XTC on, and I love his work. And he told us a story about he was looking for the 2-inch tapes. I think Todd Rundgren produced
Skylarking.
Yeah. And they couldn't find the 2-inch tapes. And Todd was saying, Jesus, I can't find the 2-inch tapes. I don't know where they're at, you know, whatever. And it was never a really good relationship between those two anyway. And then
I remember that very well.
Yeah. So Andy was watching this interview of Todd in his studio, and he sees right behind Todd on a shelf the XTC tapes.
Oh, the ones he couldn't find.
And so he then used that.
I got a funny connection. That's a funny connection, because I played Todd XTC because I didn't think our recordings were going that well, and I wanted to play him something that I thought was a really good example of what I was hearing in my head. So I played him some XTC. I think it was Big Express, David Lord record, who Natasha and I worked with as well. Funny enough, that was kind of intense other thing. But he had never heard XTC, you know, and then next thing you know, his Skylarking comes out.
You were the gateway.
I mean, I must assume that I could have been, you know, but and I remember meeting Andy through a mutual friend that worked with them. And asking him about David Lord, and he said really good things about David Lord. And then when the working with David Lord, it wasn't exactly like that. Like, you know, it's one of those things. I was like, oh, I always wanted to say, well, I got you first.
You've been involved in so many interesting projects, and I know we're only going to be able to scratch the surface here on most of those, but is there a project that you were offered to take part in, but you couldn't, and you kind of regret not being able to make that happen?
Not really. I mean, there was a couple of times there was one, where I was asked to work, Metallica cover, Christina Aguilera singing. And I was just overwhelmed at the time, not feeling very well, mentally, you know, and I knew it was going to be a really intense, to be around that kind of, you know, that world, you know, cause you know, I'm more kind of the alternative, you know, stoner desert, you know, chill, everybody, hey, what's up, you know, and almost all the stuff that I've been a part of is some kind of more alternative artistic lean that doesn't involve massive pressure from you know, the pop world or you know, the big leagues. And I think I'm not really I mean, technically speaking, and I sure I could do amazing stuff, but it's just that kind of like ego world and you know, stress world that can happen in those projects. That's more for like younger people to deal with, you know. So I kind of wish, like, man, that would have been really interesting if I did that. But no, I've been really lucky that almost maybe one or two things didn't work out that great. But you know, talking about out of 100. Projects that I've been involved in, and I've been a part of some pretty incredible things, you know.
I noticed you were also on Silverchair's Young Modern album, which here in Australia, I mean, Silverchair, I mean, I think they are so underappreciated.
I love that band. We opened up for them when they were kids, and the moms were on tour with them, the three moms and the three kids, and so they would ask Natasha and I, what's Kurt like? What's, you know, what's Chris like? What's Eddie like? us opening up for them at the Metro in Chicago, actually, was pretty funny. They were just coming out. And then we met, because Natalie Imbruglia, and Natasha, and I mean, she was friends, you know, we were friends with her, and she was dating Daniel. And Nick Lonet, my producer friend, was working on that record. And basically we came to visit, and then he asked, Daniel asked me to play some guitar in one of the songs, some slide stuff. And as a matter of fact, that guitar, I don't remember where the studio was, because it's one of those like kind of cool studios in the house. And I left it there since then. So I know I have a guitar in the studio somewhere that I played on that
record. In Australia. So
No, it was in LA. It was okay. In LA. Yeah.
One other thing I wanted to ask you about was this contribution. What is this? Had a track on the soundtrack to The Wildlife.
Yes.
And that soundtrack is one of the very few Eddie Van Halen solo contributions. I think he had some solo work done on that. So tell me a little bit about how that soundtrack came to be, and if you have any Eddie Van Halen stories.
Well, I met him when I was a kid at the Whiskey. We had played, and he was there with Valerie. And we spoke about Holdsworth, because he said he thought that I knew who Holdsworth was by the way that I was playing. Alan Holdsworth, you know, the jazz guitar player. We were both huge fans of his. And I was kind of early having solo records of and records that Holdsworth played on vinyl in the 70s, you know. But I was obviously a huge fan. And I loved Van Halen. I loved seeing them live in the early days, too. I think that was on San Andreas Records. So that was basically what MCA said, we need a hip label. And I remember like they came up with this idea, San Andreas. And so if it's a hit, it's our fault. And I was just like, oh God, it's terrible. And there's a hand coming out of the fault line holding vinyl, San Andreas Records. Yeah, I think that was that. So they said, oh, cool, we got your song on this movie. And I was like, well, that's a cool soundtrack, you know. Mm-hmm. I think it was Mine Might Have Still I got on there. I think it was even an earlier mix than the one that ended up on the EP.
How did they find you? How did that music make it to the movie?
I think it's because the label was putting out the thing, and so they kind of the music supervisor must have been approached by the labels. Hey, we got this cool band. This could be a good, obviously, you know. They have to like it and stuff. So I think they thought it was cool, and we ended up being on there. That's funny, because people don't know that it's really cool. Sometimes I forget that was one of our first like, ooh, you know, it's a good, like, make your mother proud moment. You know, my grandmother.
Oh, absolutely!
Like, it was a good idea after all, because I was good at school. Even though my family are all entertainers and musicians, they kind of decided that I would be the straight guy in the family, like get a normal job so I could pay for everyone's stuff later on when they got older. And so we were kind of in a race to convince our parents that we should be doing this full time and you know, not have it to continue going on to university or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
So the second we got that record deal, and it took us a while. We were playing all the time, and we were already super good. So I was like 22 or 21 but we were already kicking ass at 17, you know, playing clubs, you know. So we're almost getting like, you know, a little bit frustrated, like, oh, I've been around for a while.
Yeah. Was there ever a plan B? Was there ever, well, if this doesn't work out, I could always fix carburetors?
Well, you know what? I don't know. There were dark moments too, like with What Is This? Because, you know, again, it wasn't for some reason, like, just not lucky with labels pushing. Like, it was almost like sometimes with 11, we would look good on the roster and they would attract other bands because, oh, 11's cool, they're artistic, uncompromising, you know. There was no real plan B. And it just kind of like, I trusted that somehow it would work out, because obviously, it was so living and breathing it since I was a kid, you know, and I knew that we were really good, and I knew that we just had to be patient, and You know, that's the thing is that we never really fit in, you know, from what is this to 11. And then with Natasha, especially her and I, even more so, it was a little, it was always hard for them to figure out what it was, categorizing it, you know, because it was too pop for alternative to them, too alternative for rock, too rock for this, too prog for that. It was there's two singers, one's a guy, there's a girl. It's like they couldn't figure out what it was. Organ trio, you know, she's playing Moog bass and, you know, through a bass amp, and that's the bass player. And yeah, it's like, you know, 11 was definitely not.
I always thought of 11 kind of like almost like a modern Velvet Underground, right? You know, it didn't sell as many records, but it was really interesting and it inspired a ton of different people to.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, so one of the sad things, because Natasha passed before she really realized that the impact was, you know, was coming. Like the since she passed, just the awareness and the fact that you know, so many 11 fans have appeared, new generations have appeared, the YouTube thing, you know, with making it accessible, and all that stuff, and like here, like, you know, in Chile, there's a tremendous amount of 11 fans, you know, and I got my trio here, we play some 11 songs and solo stuff, and we're really considered one of the, you know, one of the top bands of that whole period. Mm-hmm. Even though we're never as popular or sold as many records, you know.
Yeah. All right, well, you got so much stuff going on here, Alan. What's kind of next? I know it's been a couple years since Hum came out, which I think came out in the middle of the pandemic. I don't
yes.
know if that was good or bad or whatever, but
no, I know. It was crazy. I actually had survived a really bad early COVID because I produced a band in Naples and got sick in end of 2019 before they knew what it was, and surviving that is what basically led to Hum. You know, I'm gonna be doing some recording in December with my trio. We're gonna finally finish our record with Cote Fonseca, Fela Fonseca. I'm doing a solo record around the same time, and I'm going on tour next year, and I'm coming to Australia in June. Excellent. So I'm going to be really excited about that. Playing about 6 or 7 shows to be announced. All the details are going to be announced soon. And before they're going to be playing in Europe and the UK, going to do a little bit of a push, do some touring, and then I'll have some new material to play. So it's going to be very exciting.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. And that's great news, especially you coming down to Australia. Not the best time of year in Australia, but that'll be fine. We'll be indoors, I'm sure.
True. It's going to be winter, isn't it? It's almost winter in June.
Well, winter. Who knows what we did to this planet? It may be beautiful. It may be.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to
it. It may be perfect beach weather.
Yeah, I haven't been since my tour when I was a part of the Hope Six band with PG Harvey. Oh. 2017, and it was the last time I've been to Australia. Okay. I went there with Queens in 2005, Crooked Vultures in 2010 or 11, I think it was.
2009,
yeah.
I think
it was amazing. I love it.
Excellent. Well, mate, looking forward to hosting you down here. And again, I want to just remind folks, 11 Howling Book, first time on vinyl, out December 1st. Grab a copy at orgmusic.com. And let's all light a candle and pray that the rest of the 11 catalog will someday make it back to vinyl. Alan, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you, brother.
Oh, man, we just scratched the surface on the history of that dude. Incredible, incredible musician. I mean, if you're unfamiliar, look them up on YouTube and you get the album Spark and Hum. They are absolute stunners. Both available on Ipecac Records. And again, don't forget Howling Book, available December 1st at orgmusic.com or from your local record shop. And that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Hey, do us a favor. Jump on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and leave us a positive review. Give us 5 out of 5 or 10 out of 10 stars. Say something nice. That is always hugely appreciated. And those of you who are sharing these episodes on social media, a big mwah goes out to each and every one of you. You can put that one wherever you want. We'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some records, people. Cheers.